This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the middle of the Nevada desert, a model community was set up to undergo an atomic blast under controlled test conditions. Inside the houses, various mannequins were arranged to simulate American families at home, unaware of the imminent disaster.
We wake up today, as every day, with an uncontrollable nuclear wound on the far side of the world. The truth is out. Three Japanese reactors are melting down. I'm Alex Smith. In this Radio EcoShock special, you will hear the evidence, the testimony, the awful facts for the frightened people of Japan, for the world. Radioactive fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi reactors has been measured on a hill just behind my home. Very small amounts have spread across the Northern Hemisphere, from America through Glasgow, Switzerland, Eastern Europe, Russia, on into Asia, China, Korea, and even the Philippines. Perhaps only earthquake-struck New Zealand remains untouched as yet. A greater global tragedy and personal threat to you may or may not happen. Certainly the island of Japan is blighted, and oceans around the world are becoming more radioactive every day. We'll talk risks and pass on civil defense tips, survival information that is coming out of Japan. In the second half of the hour, we're going to zero in on one of the most dangerous nuclear reactors in the United States. You will hear from longtime activist Rochelle Becker and lawyer Stephen Weissman. Out of 100 old and dangerous American nukes, which did we pick as the most dangerous American nuclear reactor of the week? Here is your first clue. At what reactor complex were 1,900 people arrested in a few weeks, the largest anti-nuclear record in American history?
You have 60 seconds.
Hey, I know that one, man.
Starts with a B.
Then what is it, man?
I knew it when I came in here, man.
Ends with a B.
No, don't tell me. Happy birthday.
10 seconds, Bob.
But what about this meltdown? Why should you believe as I do? The Japanese government and the utility TEPCO have said for over a week that a partial meltdown, whatever that means, is occurring at all three Fukushima Daiichi reactors that had fuel in them when the earthquake struck. That's numbers 1 to 3. First report, a Russian expert, Professor Vladimir Kuznetsov, an advisor to Russia's state nuclear monopoly, Rosatom, was quoted in the Hindu newspaper saying, "In all likelihood, fuel at the second reactor is melting and burning through the reactor containment and may get into the ocean and the soil," end quote. But I've heard some Russian scientists say some outrageous things about climate change or the source of oil, for example. We need more than that. The most serious report of a meltdown was published in the Guardian newspaper on Tuesday, March 29th. Richard Leahy, former head of safety research for General Electric, for these very type of reactors, said the core of the reactor seems to have melted through the containment vessel bottom, dripping lava-like, extremely radioactive material onto the concrete floor of reactor number 2. If true, that is certainly at least the partial meltdown Japanese authorities talked about, if not, a possible start to the much-feared China syndrome, where nuclear material melts down through concrete and rock to reach the nearby water table, only to explode, releasing horrible radiation into the atmosphere. Japanese authorities downplay that possibility, but can we trust them? For me, the third and final confirmation of multiple meltdowns comes from Tokyo Electric, TEPCO, in their press conference. Remember, Leahy in The Guardian was talking about reactor number 2, which the Japanese government has continually called the most serious, where they are trying to control melting fuel rods, a heating reactor, and major radioactive leaks. But TEPCO also found tons of extremely radioactive water in the other two reactors and adjacent turbine halls, reactors 1 and 3. On Monday in Japan, in a news story filed March 29th in the English-language version of the Korean news service Donga.com, we find the following. In a news conference Monday evening, a corporation source said, quote, "Pressure vessels number 1 and 3 were damaged and open to the air. You can imagine the images of pressure vessels with punctures," adding, "Water has not been filled to capacity in nuclear reactors despite efforts to inject water, perhaps because pressure vessels have punctures," end quote. If the 16-centimeter thick pressure vessels have punctures, melted nuclear fuel could have fallen into the bottom of the vessels to form a puncture of the inner wall of the vessels, could have melted, the corporation said. And that's the end of the quote from Donga.com. If TEPCO has admitted all three reactor vessels have been punctured, we can assume triple meltdowns are occurring. Even ABC News America is warning Tuesday, the 29th, of a possible multiple meltdown. According to ABC News, nuclear inspector Katsumo Yokata, who spent 5 days examining reactor number 2 recently and received a year's limit of radiation in just 5 days, he says there is a crack in that reactor. ABC said there could be multiple meltdowns releasing huge quantities of radiation. In the same story, the International Atomic Energy Agency, who have been always on the side of the nuclear industry, said the reactors have now cooled enough that, quote, a wild explosion is now out of the question, end quote. And barring the unpredictable, says ABC, they don't see a big spike of radiation coming. Other experts are saying the Japanese accident is already worse than Chernobyl. The news goes up and down day by day. Oh, it's horrible. Oh, it's fine. Hour by hour, depending on who you believe. Certainly, the Japanese government is now admitting this accident is out of control, polluting their country and the ocean. They are now discussing putting a special fabric cover over the reactors to limit the release of radioactive particles, but I expect that fancy plan to drop by the time you hear this. As I said in my podcast, Japan Atomic Emergency Number 5, I expect the former main island of Japan to become split into two parts, connected by a narrow road and rail isthmus running up the west coast of the island. Bloomberg News is reporting businesses are moving office space and production facilities out of Tokyo and into the former commercial center of Osaka. That's about 520 kilometers or 320 miles southeast of Tokyo. A lot of Tokyo residents have left the city for the southern part of the island, fearing radiation and seeking safe drinking water. According to Japanese TV, radiation has been found in the soil 200 kilometers away from the Fukushima reactor, about 125 miles, and I think when they do more testing, they'll find it further than that. I expect the entire central portion of Japan will be too radioactive for farming or habitation for at least 30 years. Be sure and sign up for our podcast on the main page at ecoshock.org to get those periodic updates. The emergency reports are free without any advertising or need to sign up for anything. Click and get them as they come out at ecoshock.org. Farming the constant stream of news for you, another trend is developing. The Japanese economy is falling fast and may take the rest of the world with it into a new depression. Just take this one story. The Mitsui-owned ship MOL Presence was turned away from the Japanese port of Xiamen in Fujian province last week because the container ship was too radioactive. The boat registered at 3.5 microsieverts per hour. Mitsui Company says that big ship has been in Tokyo Harbor for only a few hours on March 17th. In that short time, the ship became radioactive and its cargo refused by China, a major trading partner. How many Japanese ships are radioactive? What about their cargo? How will they be decontaminated? Many shipping lines are now refusing to go to Japan, saying their insurance won't cover radiation damage to the ships or the crew. The world's third largest economy and one of the world's biggest exporters is becoming shunned. What about the airplanes coming into Tokyo and other Japanese airspace? Lufthansa stopped flying there almost as soon as the accident was announced. Are other aircraft radioactive after flying through Fukushima emissions, and how will those be cleaned up? World trade and manufacturing is already being hit, especially the electronics and car industries. Car plants all over the world are shutting down or preparing for shutdown due to lack of Japanese parts in that just-in-time delivery system. Companies are announcing diversification, and we may see a blow to globalization. TEPCO stock has fallen over 70%. It will likely be nationalized, putting all the damage costs on the Japanese taxpayer. We can expect the same in any reactor meltdown anywhere in the world. The Japanese stock market has lost billions and billions of dollars, and this will echo out into the rest of the world economy. Japanese hospitals say they have practically no expertise in handling radiation victims. They haven't seen them for so long. The system is not prepared for what is coming. On Wednesday, the Telegraph newspaper reported people coming from Fukushima are being turned away from hospitals and clinics, no matter what their complaints, for fear they are radioactive. The heartless shunning of survivalism has begun in Japan. Meanwhile, Japan authorities are caught between two awful choices, neither of which will save them. Deadly radioactive water has appeared in trenches outside the reactors, and they lead into the Pacific Ocean. These trenches are anywhere from 16 meters, or 52 feet deep, to 22 meters. The water within them triggers nausea with a 30-minute exposure and death if exposed for 4 hours. One trench is about a meter from the surface before it overflows, and another just 10 centimeters below the ground. Trying to control the tons of extremely dangerous water filling the buildings and the trenches, Japan at midweek tried to reduce the water being pumped into critical reactor number 2 by 70%. The temperatures in that reactor, already beyond design capabilities, went up 20 degrees Celsius. My obvious prediction is this: as long as the winds are blowing some of the airborne radioactivity west out over the Pacific, TEPCO may try to limit that cooling water. But the minute those winds blow back over the Japanese mainland, or the melted core starts to go through the basement concrete, the authorities will pump in everything they've got. That will flood the Pacific with radiation, and it won't stop long-lasting radiation from covering large parts of Japan. If you live outside of Japan, especially in North America or Europe, pay attention to the following clips I've collected mainly from Japanese NHK World Television. You will learn how to handle yourself in a more radioactive environment and your own fate when, not if, one of the geriatric American or European reactors and their overstuffed fuel ponds blows up.
Radio EcoShock.
Do you hear what I hear?
We find ourselves in a situation where there is no optimism. We will continue to handle it in a state of maximum alert.
Earlier, NHK World's Yoshiyuki Yamasaki analyzed the current situation at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant.
We are now joined by a reporter, Yamasaki. And also, Mr. Edano urged people not to return to the evacuation range of 20 kilometers from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Yes, this 20 kilometers range was under the evacuation instruction immediately after the earthquake struck. And people, residents living in this area, had to leave this area with only things was what they were wearing at that time. And the residents were recently frequently going back to this area, and this has been spotted and reported by the self-defense force and the police. And of course, this evacuation instruction is issued based on the national law, so the residents must follow this instruction.
Japan's Nuclear Safety Commission says that people living in the area with high radiation levels should evacuate voluntarily because there is no immediate likelihood that the plant will stop emitting radiation. You're on Newsline for 3 p.m. Trace amounts of plutonium have been detected in soil samples from the compound of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, says the level detected is low and does not pose a threat to human health. The government said further monitoring will be conducted to judge the possible effects and is making all-out efforts to contain the situation.
We have very high radioactivity in the water that is flooded in the vicinity. And this too is proof of this comes from the reactor. It is serious, but our intention is to try to contain the impact on the peripheral areas.
Chief Cabinet Secretary Edano said the concentrations of the plutonium were normal and found in the environment caused by past nuclear testings abroad. But he said the types of plutonium included those found in nuclear fuel, making it most likely that reactor fuel rods were the source.
We talked to Dr. Naoto Sakimino of Tokyo University, and he has pointed out that the crane that has been used to transport the fuel has dropped as the ceiling caved in. He talks about the instrument that hangs from the crane, which has apparently fallen on the nuclear fuel rods, and there is likelihood that the fuel has been damaged and the radioactive material may have been released as a consequence, and that likelihood cannot be denied. This is reactor number 4. The walls have caved in, and we see vapor gushing out from various openings.
Tokyo Electric Power Company says the concentration of radioactive substances in the water in the turbine building for the number 2 reactor on Sunday was 100,000 times higher than is usual in water inside a reactor. The water surface had a radiation level of more than 1,000 millisieverts per hour. In earlier tests, 10,000 times the usual level of radiation was found in water in the turbine buildings for the number 1 and 3 reactors. In the number 1 reactor's turbine building, TEPCO is trying to speed up work to pump the radioactive water from the basement into the turbine condenser for storage. As for the water in the number 2 and 3 reactor's turbine buildings, the company found the turbine condensers couldn't hold any more water. TEPCO says it's considering emptying the condensers into adjacent pools and then filling them with the contaminated water.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meter. Nuclear power.
The radioactive material has been detected in water and food, and many people are worried and have started to stock up on food and water, and the store shelves are now empty.
The iodine accumulation may have an impact on young children. And through breastfeeding, iodine could possibly be transferred to children who are nursing. What about pregnant women? Fetus may be influenced. However, for the fetus to accumulate more than 50 milli iodine, that also requires longer than 6 months' consumption of 2 liter water by the mother. So pregnant women should not be extremely worried about the current situation.
Legal limits were exceeded in 12 locations in Ibaraki Prefecture on the 18th and on 11 locations in Tochigi and Gunma Prefecture on the 19th. On the 20th, the limits were exceeded in a place more than 200 kilometers away from the troubled nuclear power plant. Altogether, these locations spread in 50 municipalities. Analyses show that most radioactive iodine remains on the surface of vegetables. The iodine don't go into the ground easily, so it is not absorbed through the roots of vegetables. The radioactive iodine that has fallen on the ground doesn't easily get in through the roots. If you just have to wash the dirt, and radish and root vegetables are not contaminated. Even though the radioactive iodine attaches the surface, if you peel, the radiation level can be reduced significantly. You can remove much of the radioactive iodine by taking off outer leaves of the cabbage. Vegetables come in many shapes. Radioactive iodine doesn't attach to and stay on some vegetables easily. An elevated level of radioactive iodine with one vegetable doesn't mean that all vegetables are dangerous. I wish people make calm judgment before eating.
What about the risk of the pregnant woman? And in order to consider this, I think that the case of Chernobyl is very helpful. In 1986, just like the current Japan, there was 25 years ago, there was a nuclear accident. And the result was, during that time, that less than 10 years old children, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and they detected that the morbidity of the thyroid gland cancer. It did increase, but as an adult, there are no increase of the cancer incident, including the leukemia. And in the former Soviet Union, in milk And just as Japan is doing, they are detecting the radioactive materials in the vegetables and the raw milk. They did not inspect this. And also that the children intake a lot of milk, and therefore that many of them fell ill of the radioactivity, especially the thyroid gland. In order to grow the children, for the metabolism of the children, that the hormone is necessary. If they intake the iodine, that the younger the child is, that the more of the iodine can be concentrated into the gland, thyroid gland, and so that a much milk consuming the children, and the children that are in the growth stage fell victim of this radioactivity.
Radioactive iodine will not decrease because it has already dissolved in the water, so boiling will not help. And there are various household water purifiers, but they will not necessarily be effective in filtering out radioactive iodine.
Concentrated radioactive substances have also been detected in soil at a village 40 kilometers from the quake-stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Professor Muramatsu says the level is 1,600 times higher than normal. A disaster task force measured radioactive substances in soil about 5 centimeters deep at 6 locations around the plant from last Friday through Tuesday. The results announced on Wednesday show the 163,000 becquerels of radioactive cesium-137 per kilogram of soil has been detected in Itate Village, about 40 kilometers northwest of the plant. Professor Muramatsu says the normal levels of radioactive cesium-137 in soil are around 100 becquerels at most. The professor warns that since radioactive cesium remains in the environment for about 30 years, it could affect agricultural products for a long time. He's calling on the government to collect detailed data and come up with ways to deal with the situation.
In the past, we had the Chernobyl accidents. Those who were not irradiated started showing some health symptoms in their internal tracts and other areas of body. So this is a secondary medical issues caused by psychological impacts of this phenomena. So on the part of the government and on the nation as a whole, we have to be ready to take care of psychological needs of people in this situation.
This man has borne the scars of nuclear disaster for most of his life. As a resident of Nagasaki, Yoshiri Yamawaki has had liver and kidney problems since he was 35, and he's already beaten cancer twice. Every time he falls ill now, he fears it could be his last battle. Yoshiro watches events unfold at Fukushima, fearing the true nature of the disaster is yet to show itself.
The result of the contamination won't just end after the event. It'll be handed down from generation to generation. I have four daughters. The first two have leukemia. Another has breast cancer. The results of a disaster will be shown in generations to come.
Yoshiro was just 11 when the bomb was dropped. He survived the blast, but was exposed to lethal levels of radiation on his two trips to the hypercenter. First to find his father, then to bury him.
Japan's Independent Nuclear Safety Commission believes that highly radioactive substances found in the water may have come from the vessel containing the reactor. The water in the tunnel for the number one reactor unit will overflow if the level reaches more than 10 centimeters. TEPCO employees are piling up sandbags and concrete around the mouth of the tunnels to prevent flooding. To prevent further leakage, the company has also reduced the amount of water injected to cool the number two reactor, but the temperature inside has risen by 20 degrees Celsius. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edano says in dealing with both inflow and outflow of water, workers are facing one of the most difficult tasks.
While the sand slipped through the opening, and their hands reached for the golden ring, with their hearts they turn to each other's hearts for refuge. The troubled years that came before the deluge.
On the Real News Network, Dr. Robert Alvarez explains to Daphne Wisham of Earthbeat how America is just in such a bad situation with its own spent fuel pools, and we'll be going on to the situation in America in the next segment of Radio EcoShock.
And what we found is that these pools are vulnerable, and that the United States, for the last several decades, has permitted the reactor operators to put as much as four times more in the spent fuel pools than their designs envisioned.
Four times.
That's right.
So just relative to what's happening in Fukushima, do we have four times the quantity of what is now being stored at the reactors in Fukushima?
Oh, easily, and then more.
No, but I mean at each reactor.
That's right. I mean, the Fukushima reactors that are now undergoing this crisis, and they're not yet out of the woods, and the pools are part of that.
Right.
Problem. Basically on the average contain about 100 metric tons. Spent fuel pools in the United States contain as much as 500, 600, 700 metric tons.
After the deluge, let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children dry. Let creation reveal its secrets by and by.
So what will happen in Japan? No one really knows. We've never seen this, a multiple reactor meltdown before. As one person commented on a fascinating Fukushima thread at theoildrum.com, Japan is at war. The enemy is of her own making. A tiny army, not more than 800 men, is fighting to save their country from utter devastation, to save the world from even more radiation. All they can do is stay until they are too sick to remain, running the pumps to slosh around water loaded with radioactive isotopes month upon month, trying to cool the damaged reactors. It could take years if enough workers are willing to die for the mother country. There is some good news. According to David Lockbaum for the Union of Concerned Scientists, proper pumping equipment is keeping the hyper-dangerous spent reactor rods at least covered in their pools. They are using seawater. That's not good. The pools may be damaged and leaking. Certainly heavy equipment and parts of the blown-off roofs have fallen on those carefully spaced rods. But Lockbaum predicts radiation from that source may be limited to what has already escaped. The reactors themselves and all the rad water they are leaking out are another matter. When the Prime Minister of Japan goes on national TV saying, "This is no time for optimism," things are bad. You were alive to witness one of the great events of all human history. Radioactivity already released will be recorded in geological history for at least a half a million years. We have again changed the planet, just as we do with our carbon burden daily. As with the insane atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons during the Cold War, we are adding yet another layer of radioactivity to our precious Earth. That will cost us and cost our children dearly. The only hope, where there is hope, is that you and everyone you know will make an end to the rest of this danger. Shut down the nuclear power plants. Shut them down. Humans have lived without electricity for more than 100,000 years. I lived without it for 10 years, and they were good times. We are better to get up and then slumber in time with the sun to run the small things, whatever solar and wind power we can make, than ever to risk our lives, our very planet, to the killing power of the atom. Shut them down. I'm Alex Smith. Our website is ecoshock.org. Find this show block at ecoshock.info. When we come back, a close-up look at one of America's most dangerous nuclear plants.
The Environmental Protection Agency keeps track of radiation levels in the air through a system called RadNet. On the EPA website, you can see these systems are in place throughout the country. Two located in Michigan, one right here in Grand Rapids. For security reasons, we can't show you the exact location of the Grand Rapids site, but the system is maintained by the Kent County Health Department.
Our staff monitor and change the filters on that equipment and make sure that it is transmitting the information to the EPA on basically a biweekly basis.
The EPA site provides maps, graphs, and statistics in almost real time. It highlights the date of the reactor disaster in Japan and provides daily updates. For example, the homepage mentions the recent detection of minute radiation in rainwater collected in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts. Earlier posts discussed elevated air radiation detected in California, Washington State, and Hawaii. The EPA saying all increased levels were expected and pose no human health risk.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith, and I'm looking forward to talking with our next guest, Rochelle Becker. She's been a battler, a citizen activist against nuclear power, for the environment, for mothers, and for abused children, for the living against deadly technology. She was just in the New York Times last week, now that Japanese reactors are threatening that country. Rochelle is the executive director of the California Group Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Rochelle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's nice to be here.
Out of 100 doddering and dangerous American reactors, we're looking into the Diablo Canyon plant near San Luis Obispo. Just to orient us, where is that on the California coast?
Well, San Luis Obispo is a charming little community. Actually, it was voted best place to live in the world not too long ago, but I'm not sure they would still say so. And it's located about 90 miles north of Santa Barbara, about, oh, let's say 150 miles north of Los Angeles.
And before we go into real details, why should we care at all whether the reactors at Diablo Canyon keep operating?
Well, the Diablo Canyon reactors are located within 3 miles of two active earthquake faults, and they're located within 5 kilometers of 4 faults, but two are offshore major faults. And according to the California Energy Commission and the state legislature, California needs the utilities to do new seismic studies before they can continue with operation. And that was a decision that was made by the California Energy Commission long before the seismic tragedy happened in Japan.
So we have two reactors run by the private utility company PG&E. Looking at the pictures of the site, I don't see cooling towers. How are these reactors cooled?
Well, they are cooled by a process known as once-through cooling. The water goes in, it cools the reactor, and goes back out again. And it goes in and out at a million gallons a minute every single day.
And as you know, right now in Japan, radioactivity is leaking into the sea, possibly through long cooling pipes leading into the ocean at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. Is it possible that could happen after an earthquake at Diablo Canyon?
Well, it would be somewhat different, but the possibilities are the same. These are radioactive waste facilities. They store the radioactive waste on site as well as produce power. The radioactive waste is stored in what they call a spent fuel pool configuration, which is overcrowded. The original design has had to be packed tighter and tighter as the industry has not been able to find a place in the United States to store this waste that's produced at every reactor. While the reactors have 6-foot-thick steel-reinforced concrete, the waste facility, the big problem in Japan right now is the spent fuel pools, and the spent fuel pools at Diablo Canyon and at San Onofre South in California, neither one have the robust buildings that they do for the reactor sites themselves.
So are they protected against, for example, terrorism?
They certainly are not protected against a plane flying into those facilities. They were never built to withstand that. And so they've compensated with other factors. But, you know, if a plane wanted to fly in, they're right there on the ocean bluffs. If a ship went by with some sort of a device, I don't know much about weapons, thank heavens, but it certainly is vulnerable to terrorism. Both the plants are, and the Diablo Canyon plant sits just north of the Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is our communications center for the United States for many things, including the military operations. And the San Onofre plant sits on the Marine base, which is the staging ground for most of the Marines that go to defend our country. Whether you like them to defend our country or not, we certainly don't want to see them killed by a radioactive accident in our own state.
Right. So let's talk about the earthquake risk. That's been a hot topic there for several decades. Can you tell us more about these fault lines near the Diablo Canyon reactors and maybe when they were discovered?
Yes, the original design for Diablo Canyon, when they originally got a state certification, there were no known earthquake faults within almost 50 miles. The closest fault was the San Andreas fault, which is a rather famous fault, but it was certainly not close to the plant. During construction of the plant, actually when it was almost completely built, an organization found a memo from actually the Shell Oil Company that said, wait a minute, there's an earthquake fault that's active 2.5 miles from the gate of that plant. And we took that information immediately to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and said, wait a minute, you've just missed this. You might want to reconsider this plant before you go forward. And the NRC said, no, you know, we don't think that's a problem. PG&E said, no, it's not a problem. It's a dormant fault. You don't need to worry about it. Many millions, actually billions of dollars later, the NRC finally admitted that, yes, that fault is an earthquake fault that could impact the licensing of the plant. And yes, that plant now needs to be redesigned to compensate for the earthquake fault that they didn't know about when they built the plant. And that process started, and PG&E was supposed to independently verify that they had done the work that the NRC had asked them to do. And PG&E got caught with their consultant sending their information to the utility before they sent it to the NRC. And the NRC, PG&E was the first plant in the country to have its license that had just been granted by the NRC revoked by the NRC. So there are serious seismic problems at Diablo Canyon. When PG&E applied for a license renewal to extend their license for an additional 20 years late in 2009, the Alliance flew back and met with the chairman of the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and said, you know, your seismic history at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is full of controversy, and no one in the state of California trusts the NRC to do the right thing. And we are asking you to stay this license renewal, to work with the state of California's seismologists who are asking for these new seismic studies, and the NRC denied that stay.
And there are people, right from state senators down through local councillors, who are objecting to this plant, who don't want it to keep going. It's really an old facility. They started in 1968 building this thing. And yet, that just doesn't seem to go anywhere. What does that say about the way nuclear plants are regulated?
What it says was the states need to step up and to protect their citizens. The states have absolutely no authority over security and safety at nuclear power plants. However, the states have full authority over the economics and the reliability of these facilities. And so we formed the alliance in 2005 after I had spent almost 30 years fighting the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with an organization called the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. And when they put in the dry cast storage facility to store the excess waste that they couldn't fit in their pools any longer and denied the contention of looking into new seismic information, and this was in 2001 to 2003. And when they said, no, we're not going to look at the new seismic information you brought forth. If you want to talk about that, you have to open the original licensing proceedings from the late 1970s. And at that point, it became abundantly clear to me that the NRC was never going to do its job when it came to nuclear power plants and earthquake faults. And it was time for the state to step up. And so the alliance was formed in 2005, and our focus is to get the state to step up to the plate, to use its jurisdiction to look carefully at whether or not the state can rely on these aging reactors and whether or not it's in their economic best interest to go forward. And in doing that, the alliance has worked with the California Energy Commission and the California Legislature and the California Coastal Commission, And they have requested and done new seismic analysis or new analysis of the cost, benefit, and risks of continuing to rely on these aging reactors. And their bottom line was, we don't have enough seismic information, and you, PG&E, and you, Southern California Edison, have to do updated seismic studies using the best available technology right now and let us know whether or not we should even consider relicensing these reactors. Both utilities have dragged their feet, and they've dragged their feet up until Japan, and they're still dragging their feet.
So they just don't even want to look into whether the fact an earthquake could damage their plant. Is that what we're saying?
If they look, they might find.
This is Radio EcoShock as we peer into the Valley of the Devil, so to speak, the Diablo Canyon nuclear generating plant right on the California coast. Rochelle Becker is the executive director for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. Rochelle, starting in the late 1970s, tens of thousands of Californians fought against this Diablo Canyon facility, mainly fearing the earthquake risk. 30,000 people marched in San Francisco alone one day. Tell us a little bit about that time.
Yes, California was united at that time. This was in the early 1980s. In fact, we even organized a sit-in at the Public Utilities Commission at the time, asking them to rescind the certificate they had given them because now we knew about a new earthquake fault. California was very united. They were sure after Three Mile Island, after the discovery of earthquake faults, that the NRC would do its job and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would deny PG&E this license. We never anticipated that the NRC would just turn their backs and say, oh, no, we trust these people to do the right thing. And they not only did that, but in the mid-1980s, they ruled that our emergency planners did not need to consider an earthquake happening that could cause a radioactive release at the Diablo Canyon facility and knock out the infrastructure that we would need in order to evacuate. They said it was too remote and speculative. Well, Japan has just proven that it's neither remote nor speculative, and the NRC needs to go back to the table. But I don't trust them to go back to the table and do the right thing. I think we could spend a lot of years and a lot of monies, and the only winners would be the utilities and the attorneys that will take these cases to go on forever. California can step up to the plate. Other states can step up to the plate. And we are hoping that California leads the way. The New York governor has says, close down Indian Point. There's 20 million people or more within 50 miles of Indian Point, and they have earthquake faults. There are 11 million people within 50 miles of the San Onofre nuclear power plant, and they have earthquake faults, and they're subject to tsunamis. These are plants that were designed in the 1960s. How many of us are driving 1960 cars? And even if there's something bad coming out of our tailpipes that are contributing to CO2 emissions, it isn't radioactive, and it won't kill you today.
How are we going to get young people interested in protecting their land from one of these Japanese-style nuclear disasters right at home?
Well, you know, that's a bit difficult because there haven't been any new reactors that have actually been built. We've talked about them, but they haven't actually come to town anywhere in the United States. And the young people are very, very concerned about global climate change and what will happen in the CO2 from the global climate change and the pollution. So rightly so, they have been indoctrinated by the administration, both Republicans and Democrats. They've been indoctrinated by scientists who are saying, oh, no, 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 we have got to clean up our air. And I couldn't agree more. But you don't trade one poison for another poison. You look for positive solutions. And the nuclear industry doesn't have any positive solutions. They say these new reactors are better built. These new reactors won't happen what happens in Japan. And that's absolutely true. As long as they stay on the drawing board, those new reactors are just fine.
You've been fighting this cause for about 3 decades, and I'm sure I've missed some important issue. Is there something else you'd like to talk about?
I think that what I would really like to stress with your audience is that while the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is no different than the Nuclear Safety Commission in Japan, who 2 weeks ago would have said this can't happen here and would have said these plants are built to withstand anything that's coming, what happens is you have to imagine the unimaginable. The results of the 9/11 Commission after the terrible terrorist attack in New York was that the United States failed to imagine the unimaginable. Japan has just proven that we continue to fail to imagine the unimaginable, but that it happens. And we no longer are going to get too many more warnings. Japan happened this month, but it makes no difference because California could happen next month or any of the other 23 reactors in the United States that are built just like the ones in Japan.
And as we wrap up, can you give us the web address for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility and any other resources you'd like to recommend?
Absolutely. The Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility is www.anr.org. If you do anr.org, you will get a Japanese site, which is rather coincidental at the moment. So it's anr.org. Now, there's also other information nationwide that would be Beyond Nuclear. The Union of Concerned Scientists has excellent information, and they have a daily blog updating with technical information. They couldn't be a better site. And if you want to talk to the Mothers for Peace, who continue to have legal interventions at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and still believe, you know, that the right people can change, that would be Mothers for Peace, San Luis Obispo, mothersforpeace.org. All of those sites are excellent sites for information and also to find out what you can do. We have two action letters on our website that go to the Public Utilities Commission in California and to the governor in California. And I really hope that your listening audience, no matter where they are, will send in that action letter and assert the state's rights, because that's the only thing that's going to kill these nuclear plants.
Our guest, Rochelle Becker, has spoken out at public utility meetings, regulatory meetings, and just too many rooms full of suits, trying to make a state safe from nuclear radiation. She's been the conscience riding the nuclear industry and a welcome guest here on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much, Rochelle.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
To talk about the ongoing problems at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Generation Station, we are joined by Stephen Weissman, a lecturer in residence at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also director of the Energy and Clean Tech Program there. Previously, Stephen was an administrative law judge for the California Public Utilities Commission. Stephen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
About a week after the Japanese earthquake brought the nuclear disaster to Japan, you wrote an article titled Multiple Failures Exposed Diablo Canyon to Higher Risk. First of all, I just wanted to ask you, why did you choose to write about Diablo Canyon?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, I actually, before I was an administrative law judge, I spent about 3 years as part of a team that was investigating the activities surrounding the original construction of the Diablo Canyon plant. And came to learn a lot about the utilities management structure, its decision-making processes, and the extent to which there were and were not protections put in place to ensure that the plant was designed well from the outset. When I saw the study produced by the Union of Concerned Scientists that pointed out the Diablo Canyon near miss, as they characterized it, which was one of what they said were about 14 near misses that occurred in 2010, I could see patterns that looked familiar from my past review of the Diablo Canyon plant, so I wanted to bring some of those issues to people's attention.
And what did the Union of Concerned Scientists say about this facility?
What they pointed out was that there were some valves designed in activating the emergency cooling system that were stuck in the off position for about 18 months. And during that period of time, apparently nobody at the plant nor any of the regulators knew that the valve was actually stuck.
So if they'd had an accident, perhaps their backup systems wouldn't have worked?
That's the concern. The utility said, well, we always had the option of manually activating the valves. And apparently, according to a quote in the San Francisco Chronicle, they also said, of course, the chances of this kind of accident occurring were really small anyway. Well, what seems to be missing from those comments is an understanding of the importance in a nuclear power plant of having well-functioning backup systems, because it isn't the initial problem so much that tends to cripple plants such as the ones at Fukushima. It's really the inability of the backup systems to function properly that winds up turning a potential blip into a real problem.
Well, there are a chain of regulators that are supposed to protect us, the public. We've got the Independent Safety Committee and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Did those oversight bodies work to protect us?
I certainly can't really second guess how much work and how diligently, for instance, the NRC staff tried to do their job and ferret out problems. From reports I've seen, apparently there's something like 6,400 hours of staff time a year devoted to each nuclear power plant, which means there were the equivalent of more than 3 full-time people spending time looking, for instance, at Diablo Canyon. And the question is, how do they go about doing their work? This is actually a problem that's cropped up in California recently in another sphere, which was the accident that occurred on a natural gas pipeline in San Bruno that wound up exploding and killing and injuring a number of people. And the question was, how could the California Public Utilities Commission, with I think a staff of about 15 inspectors, possibly keep on top of what's going on in several thousand miles of pipeline in the state? And the answer really has to do, I think, with the systems that are set up and the questions that are asked and the proofs that are required from the facility operators, and certainly with 6,400 hours of staff time a year at one nuclear power plant. First of all, you have the ability to have somebody on site at all times, but you certainly have the ability to always take a step backwards and look at the framework, look at the systems that are set up by the utility, by the operator of the plant, to create a fail-safe and to be able to ensure that if there's some mistake that occurs anywhere in the design or operation of the facility, that it's going to be caught quickly. With that kind of staff oversight, it's hard to imagine how you would be unable to catch those things at an earlier time. And unfortunately, in this instance, the NRC did not catch this for quite some period of time.
And you live in the San Francisco area?
Yeah.
Well, the Diablo Canyon nuke plant appears to be about 200 miles or 318 kilometers south of San Francisco. And in April 1979, 30,000 people marched at a protest in Frisco calling for a shutdown at Diablo. Are you aware of any studies showing how a meltdown there could affect San Francisco, or is there just a general public awareness of possible danger?
I'm not familiar with any particular study. I'm sure that people looked at this issue over the years. But I think what we've seen at Fukushima really gives us all a lesson about the way these things can be affecting a much broader area. You know, the debate at Fukushima has been, do you evacuate a 15 to 19-mile radius area as the Japanese authorities have required, or do you evacuate a 50-mile radius area as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States has advised them? Well, either way you look at that, you're still well short of the San Francisco Bay Area. What you do know is that you have winds that prevail off of the ocean, carrying things inland. The facilities are located on the ocean. The right wind patterns can certainly carry radiation into populated areas. You also know that there are other kinds of effects that have wound up having broader implications. The contamination of, for instance, water in Tokyo, which was not very close to the Fukushima accident. The fact that certain crops are showing signs of containing of radiation from the event at Fukushima, those things wind up having a much wider impact. And so take an area like San Francisco. Is there a plausible scenario under which there could be direct catastrophic physical impacts in the San Francisco area? You know, I'm not an authority on that. You'd have to really talk to people who've studied these things. But certainly, well, short of that, it's easy to imagine scenario having a very significant economic impact on the San Francisco area, both in terms of agriculture, but also in terms of tourism, perceptions of safety. Can you imagine a lot of people at this point saying, "Hey, what the heck? Let's go visit Tokyo now." I think you could imagine where there are going to be at least short or medium range economic impacts that could be significant on a region.
Well, sure. The agriculture industry is just huge. And, you know, if there was even a hint that there was nuclear particles on California vegetables, I just can't imagine the kind of unemployment and the economic hit the state would take. And despite the moratorium on new nuclear plants in California, a business group is trying to push construction of the state's largest facility in the interior at Fresno. But it sounds like they are trying to call it a water treatment plant with a solar facility. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Well, I haven't looked in great detail at the proposed Fresno facility. I think it's unlikely to go anywhere in the foreseeable future because of the fact that there is this very explicit moratorium in place, and it's up to the California Energy Commission to make a determination as to whether, in fact, the long-term storage capabilities exist that would support building a new plant now. And you remember, there are actually two parts of moratorium. One is one has to do with this question of whether there is in place a permanent storage capability for high-level nuclear waste, which, of course, we don't have in this country right now. But the other portion had to do with these issues of on-site storage, the use of storage pools, such as exist at Diablo Canyon, at San Onofre, further south along the coast, and certainly turned out to be perhaps the most significant issue at the Fukushima plants. It was the fact that you've got the spent nuclear fuel rods in a pool of liquid, and that liquid is so critical to keeping the fuel rods cool and to holding down the radiation releases. When the tsunami wound up affecting the systems, and which led to a loss of who knows how much of the water that was in these pools, that's where you seem to have had one of the largest threats to overheating and potential explosions and meltdowns. So they got that issue lingering out there too, and there's nothing about what happened at Fukushima to provide assurance that we've solved those problems as well. So I think that a new facility in Fresno or elsewhere is going to have a huge mountain to climb to overcome that moratorium. And you have to think that perhaps this is more being offered more as a morality play in an effort to try to convince people to change the law and remove the moratorium than it is an effort to actually get a plant cited under the current laws.
Steve, you're also working on energy and clean tech. Briefly, how is California doing when it comes to bringing on clean sources so we could replace those risky nuclear plants?
California is doing a lot better than a lot of other places. It's not doing as well as it had hoped. There was a goal established by legislation a number of years ago that the utilities in California received 20% of their delivered power from renewable sources, and that the deadline for that was the end of 2010. We're into 2011 now, and none of the three major utilities has hit those targets, but they're significantly going down the road toward getting there. They're in the teens in terms of the percentage of power that's delivered from renewable sources, and those goals were really more aspirational than scientifically derived. So the targets have been effective in terms of spurring the utilities and the regulators into action. We now have more ambitious goals that are likely to be signed into law very, very shortly that would have us aiming for 33% renewable energy by the year 2020. These are more ambitious goals than exist most anywhere else in the country, not only because of the percentage of power that's supposed to be renewable, but also because of the way renewable power is defined. When President Obama in the State of the Union address didn't even talk about renewable power, he talked about what he referred to as clean energy, and he talked about the fact that right now you could conclude that 40% of the power nationwide is provided by clean energy sources. Well, in order to get that at 40%, see, not only is he counting things like nuclear power, but he's also counting large hydro facilities, the kind of dams that provide a significant percentage of the power in California. Well, California, when it established its renewable goals, elected not to count large-scale hydro plants. So the targets that are set in California are more pure targets. A lot of other states are counting large-scale hydros. So California is doing pretty darn well compared to other states.
Mind you, when we talk about costs, the nuclear critics have been worrying for years that a future society might not have the money or the resources to decommission these nuclear plants, even if we do decide to shut them down. Given the state of California is fighting off bankruptcy, the federal government has record debt, I wonder if we're already there. Can anybody afford to clean up this mess if we did stop the relicensing of Diablo Canyon?
This is one area where the state demonstrated foresight from the outset. When Diablo Canyon was placed into rates, it established a decommissioning trust fund, and there's been a portion of utility rates since the 80s that has gone into this trust fund, and that set-aside still exists. The biggest challenges really relate to the success and failure of the trustees in terms of managing those funds, and also in our inability to very accurately anticipate exactly what it's going to cost to decommission these plants. So there are still some risks, even in California, as to whether there will be enough money set aside for decommissioning, but at least there is a very significant set aside.
I'm surprised to hear that. Well, this is an ongoing issue. I appreciate your input. We've been talking with environmental lawyer Stephen Weissman. He lectures at the University of California, Berkeley. He works on clean tech and writes about energy, including nuclear power. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
After the 9.0,
You are listening to California artist Vast Man. Find him at SoundClick.
Or we'll get burned. Oh, the planet's been speaking. More loudly these days, the call of tragedy.